Hello, everyone. Welcome to Podwarp 1999, Season 2, Episode 5. With us today, we have Jim Francis.
Hello.
Tom Trzowski.
Hello.
Mark Meckes.
Hello.
Ben Padden.
Goodbye.
And me, David Davis.
We gotta work on the Three Stooges hello. Yeah. So, we gotta try to do that when we... You
know. David, does anyone ever remark on the fact that your first name and your last name are near identical?
All the time. It's
I'm
a good
sure
cartoonist
never
name.
Never heard that before.
It is pretty great.
Yeah.
I wonder if there was like an evil, like a parallel universe version of Jim Henson called Him Jensen.
Jensen, that's good.
Jensen, yeah. All right. Anyway, we have actual topics to discuss this week, David. Why don't you walk us through those?
Well, let's go ahead and start off and just kind of catch up with everybody. What's everybody been up to? Let's go with Jim first.
I've been slowly dying, but.
That's
not me.
That's everybody, though, isn't it?
Yeah, well, we're all marching inexorably towards the grave.
Yes, I'm dying slightly faster than normal, but not enough to really get into. So how are you doing, Mark?
I'm fine. I guess I'm dying a little bit slower than you.
Oh,
so I
that's
guess
good.
That's positive.
Excellent.
Tom?
I'm fine. haven't checked the rate lately, but I'll just assume it's good for now.
Ben?
It's weird, actually. I'm actually I'm getting younger and more strong. I caught that Benjamin Button disease that's been going around, and it's really done wonders for my complexion, for my physique. I feel stronger. I bench pressed a Citroen 2CV the other day, which is not. I mean, it's not difficult because they're really, really light and old cars, and it was falling apart as I was lifting it. But other than that. You know, I'm doing great. All my teeth are falling out. I don't know why that's happening. It's weird. but apart from, I mean, that's a small price to pay for, you know, just more being fun. Ripped.
I got a little news if I'm able to communicate it, if that's all right.
Ooh, go for it.
This May 7th at 9 a.m., I will be at Heidi Ho Comics in Santa Monica for a free comic book day mini convention. With a bunch Ooh. Of friends from my studio I work with called Imagine Everything Studios. And I believe, Ben, you have an invitation to it.
Yeah, I'm hoping to make it out to Heidi Ho, to mingle with the lower classes and just basically see how the common folk live.
All the peons, I guess.
Yeah, peons, drudgeons, your general kind of, lesser folk.
I'll go ahead and include a link to you guys later. That way, if anyone else, I don't know who else is local necessarily.
Yeah, this is where and
Santa Monica.
Santa Monica, nice.
Yeah, so yeah. Maybe we'll see Jim there.
I'm in Northern California, so it's a little far from me. But yeah,
well, you maybe can listen, drive it if you want.
Jim,
it.
If you're not willing to make the commitment.
Well, I'm totally not, so...
Okay.
But, yeah, so I got that going for me.
Cool. I'm looking forward to actually getting to see your entire face.
Yeah, more than just a beard. There's more to me than just a beard.
There's more than just a beard.
And then in fall, I will be starting at Cal State San Marcos for my master's degree in literature and writing studies.
Nice.
So, yep, pretty happy about that.
Are you going to become one of those insufferable people who can't, sit down and watch a movie like going, they could have streamlined the narrative if they just combined these two characters and excised
already
the scene?
Already that person.
Good grief.
Yeah, I'm already that person. It's pretty awful to watch movies with me.
So you got a good head start.
Yeah. About 5 minutes into it, I already know what's going to happen, so...
That happened to me with Wanted. Like, I think I got maybe 5 to 10 minutes into that movie and I could see exactly where the narrative was going to go. And I was just... It was kind of mentally checking off boxes as each thing... that I thought was going to happen, happened.
But did you still enjoy the movie?
No, it was garbage.
Yeah, so, thankfully it doesn't stop my enjoyment of movies. You know, I enjoy seeing that, I can break down the narrative DNA of something, but if I still enjoy the movie, I think it's a good movie.
That's fair.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
I think I like being caught off guard. Like, I really liked... when I went to see Wanted in the theater the same day, I also went to see Hancock, And I know that Hancock is a very divisive movie among people who enjoy things, but I really enjoyed Hancock because it throws that curveball at you halfway through the movie. Like, the entire ad campaign for Hancock was, what if Superman was real and homeless and kind of a jerk? And also Will Smith. So, you know, I've kind of made some of those statements redundant. And then it throws that curveball. I mean, that movie came out, what, 8 years ago now? So it's okay for me to spoil...
Right.
The curveball, right? Like,
I think you're,
you know, yeah, like, there's another character in the movie who it turns out is also like him, and they're basically, for want of a better word, angels, but not angels, they're just kind of seen as such. And because that wasn't in any of the marketing, like, the marketing department managed to not ruin the big twist halfway through the movie, which is so rare these days, that I was like, what the hell? And I was drawn into the rest of the movie, and I didn't see it coming. I love that. I love a movie that will throw a curveball at me that works. Of movies that throw curveballs at you that don't quite work aren't quite a smart. Case in point, Batman deciding not to kill Superman because their mothers have the same name.
Martha?
Yeah,
Martha. Who's Martha?
Martha Stewart, the homemaker. I'm a big fan of her books. You've got to find her and tell her that she's amazing, because I won't be able to because I'm dead. Oh,
well, I can't kill this alien. I can't kill this alien. He likes Martha Stewart. anyone else have any news they want to share?
Nine.
Okay, Jim has nine items of news.
Excellent. Go ahead.
Nine. As I offend all of our German listeners.
End of May, I'll be appearing at MegaCon here in Orlando. Anybody's going to be there.
What about this con makes it so mega?
It's pretty good size. There's
why is it a good size con?
Because I think that one's in San Diego.
Yeah.
So this one's you know mega.
The problem with good size con is they schedule it the same week as San Diego Comic Con and no one goes. Yeah. And the irony is it's getting smaller and smaller every year as attendance dwindles.
Exactly.
There you go.
It used to be actually called. It used to be called MegaCon, ironically enough, and that was 5 years ago.
All right. MegaCon. So today, I think we want to discuss horror. How do you guys feel about that? Did you just sneeze?
Apparently, I'm allergic to the concept. So,
how horrifying!
Yeah, horror's tricky.
As you give birth to some sort of demon baby out of your throat.
Yeah, I'm having a kind of H.R. Giger like Darkseid baby. Yeah, horror in webcomics is tricky. Like, I can't think of many webcomics that exist within the horror sphere. Like, the key ones I can think of are Brood Hollow by Chris Straub, who has been a guest of the show. Friend of the show, Chris Straub, who previously did Starslip, and who also does Chainsaw Suit. He does Brood Hollow, and he wrote the creepypasta Candle Cove. And then Pascal... previously of this, not I don't know if she was ever on the podcast, but
once
her sci-fi webcomic Zap was part of Quack Comics. It's a duck. Sorry, I've got something stuck in my throat. Quark Comics. She then went on to do Wildlife, which is kind of based in kind of mythology and kind of American mythology, and is a little bit kind of it's kind of one foot in that horror space, and is. Wonderfully, wonderfully written, wonderful webcomic. I'm sure there are others, but I can't really think of any other horror webcomics. Are you guys familiar with any horror out there in the webcomic sphere?
There are a lot with horror elements, but I'm not sure. I know of any that are many that are pure horror.
The closest one I can think of was...
Like, they have vampires as main characters, and there are occasionally otherworldly or the kinds
but
of
is,
things
is
that
it
you
just...
might see.
Is it the presence of the supernatural that makes something horror? I guess that's kind of where I think we should start, is kind of how do we define horror in this case?
Well, right, so it's like all definitions, they're arbitrary, but I think the definition of horror is something that is primarily trying to scare you, as opposed to, and there may be scary elements in any story, but horror is basically there for horror, for the scary part.
Yeah, because my definition of horror is based on, like, well, I see it as, like, two different things. Number one, there's the horror aesthetic, which is, like, themes and tropes and that sort of thing. And then anything that actually makes me uneasy or makes me nervous or scares me. And it's just, I don't see a whole lot of the second category. I see a lot of the first because there's a lot of cool tropes. There's a lot of cool design work that goes into what we assume is horror. But it's not necessarily scary to me.
Well, I think we mentioned this a long time ago, but the horror is difficult in comics because horror mostly either is dependent on timing, like a jump scare or something, or tension, which is often built through timing, or it's through visually unpleasant things. And you can have a flash of a visually very unpleasant image, and not have it be really overly gory or gratuitous in a movie because you only see it briefly. But if in a comic book panel, that image is there to stare at for as long as you care to. And so whenever a comic has really graphic violence, it often becomes, I mean, that's like, there are a lot of Japanese horror manga, and they're really visually graphic and grotesque often.
So I want to posit this idea that maybe the format for webcomics that we typically associate with multiple updates a week, that may actively work against horror, because just recently I was reading a bunch of horror manga by Junji Ito. I think my Japanese is terrible, but I think it's Junji Ito. But Ito? Is it Ito? Mm. Okay. So the fact that I was able to just kind of like power through and read everything in one shot, whereas if I were to take a break on it, I think it would just kill the momentum and kill the horror of it for me. So is that maybe something to take into account?
Yeah, that's a very good point. I think in addition to just the problem of pacing in comics in general, and then, you know, a weekly update or even a multiple weekly update, that would definitely kind of break the tension of a narrative.
Right. So, like, what exactly scares you guys? What makes you nervous in horror and that sort of thing?
Well, I think violence is less scary than it used to be because we're kind of almost becoming numb to it because it's so prevalent in media. So I think the scariest movies I saw recently, they're actually both M. Night Shyamalan movies. The first one was the Sixth Sense, when the part that I thought was scary, when there was a ghost of a little girl like walking down a hall, which is totally is not scary by itself, except like she appeared suddenly in a place where you didn't expect her to be, and that was really scary. And there was something like about
jump scares.
Well, it wasn't a jump scare exactly, but it was the scene had really been, there was a lot of tension in the scene, and then she doesn't jump out at you, but all of a sudden she just walks slowly and quietly past an open doorway, and you go but like another one that which I didn't actually think was a very good movie was Signs. But it established a really creepy atmosphere, and I was actually pretty creeped out by that, especially the part where they were holed up down in the basement, and you could hear the aliens skittering around. So, it's about building a mood, I think, more than specific elements.
Right.
Interesting. I'm going to go ahead and completely disagree with basically everything both of you have said. For not everything.
It wouldn't be a pod warp if you didn't do that.
I think there's a lot to disagree with. Firstly, I'm not to say that you are idiots. I'm not putting that out there, but I do fundamentally disagree with the notion that horror has to be a visual medium and a medium based entirely around the timing and, you know, flashes of imagery and so on. You cited Jim jump scares as an example of something scary, and yeah, that is something that is scary, but it's also something that within horror has diminishing returns. The more you do it within one film or one television thing or one any kind of, you know, visual medium, the less impact it has. Which is why the American horror genre is in something of, I think, of a decline. I think that the reason I disagree with that is because there is such a wealth of horror fiction. Like, if people weren't terrified of reading scary stories, of reading books that are in the horror genre, Stephen King wouldn't be the phenomenal literary success that he is. I mean, that's, again, that is something that you read at your own pace. And that is something that can build tension. And you can do that with a comic as well. Like, I'm blanking on his name again now. Junji Ito, who you mentioned previously, David, is a master at building tension and suspense using comic panels and using comic pages. Right. And it's something that he's a master at. And that's not necessarily something that all comic people can do, but to say that comics are an inherently bad form for horror, I think does disservice to the concept of horror as a medium, because I don't necessarily think it's predicated entirely around around visuals.
I don't think Jim and I were implying that though.
I don't think either of us actually said that. Right. So.
But we are talking about mostly a visual medium that is comics. So a lot of our discussion at that point was about this idea of the visual medium. But yeah, there's a wealth of like terrifying like fiction out there. One of my all-time favorite fictions that I've read was that website Ted the Caver. If you have any familiarity with it, like, it scared the crap out of me. And it was just someone who did this like little website about a guy who was exploring a cave, and he would post like photos and writing about his experience, and it was horrifying. So it's one of those things where our discussion at that point was more focused on the visual element, because we are kind of discussing comics, and that's like half of the thing.
So I think what happened is that I misinterpreted what you guys said, and then lost the call briefly, and wanted to seem like I was still engaged, so I caught the bit that I heard, and tried to run with that.
Okay, well that's nice. So in other words, you're not actually involved in the conversation. That's fantastic. What I was saying was that it's difficult to do. Well, it's difficult to do horror in any case, and. You have pretty much the same tools in comics that you have in fiction, which is that you can build a creepy or scary mood, which is actually fairly difficult to do. And there are good writers who do it well. And I was saying that in movies, kind of the cheap and obvious things that you can do to scare people are either involved with timing or they're involved with graphic imagery. Now, in fiction, the graphic imagery... you don't have the issue of things becoming overly graphic because you're just... Your prose description can be fairly can leave a lot to the imagination, and the reader can build a scary picture in his head. But in a comic panel, you're actually showing someone being disemboweled or whatever, and that's in a movie you can show that like and just flash past it, and it can be unpleasant but not overly gratuitous. Whereas in a comic panel. There's a detailed illustration of someone's guts spilling out, so it's kind of hard to do just a little bit of extreme violence. You have to either not do any or go all the way and get really grotesque.
I find that a lot of horror works best when there's a subtlety to it. Like I feel like Kolchak the Night Stalker, the original series, absolutely wonderful horror series because so much of it is left to the imagination. And usually the reader's mind can come up with stuff that's even more terrifying than you could ever draw or write. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah.
I do have an interesting quote someone gave me about this very topic. So I'm going to go ahead and read it and see what you guys think. So this comes from someone named Verum in the Spider Forest webcomic chat room, and they do a series of stories called Reaper Serial at reaperserial.wordpress.com. And here's what they had to say about horror.
That's serial as in serialized, not serial as in...
serialized, you
know.
Yeah.
Reaper Serial, that would be pretty brand tasty.
I'd be all over that. Serial. Yeah.
One bite, it'll knock you over. So here's what their quote was. Good horror doesn't scare you at the beginning. It grips you and pulls you in. It's interesting and demands attention more and more as it twists and turns. Eventually, it's horrid, everything you hate and fear. It's repulsive, but still it hangs on. You can't help but want to know more, because if you do not, it will nag at you like an earworm page after page, and able to stop it chills you to the bone. So, is there like an addictive quality to horror in that case? Is that maybe something that a writer can consciously aim for?
Yeah, I certainly think so. I mean, it's the same reason that, you know, we get on a roller coaster. We like that rush of, you know, the fear of, you know, I mean, it's one of my favorite roller coasters at Magic Mountain. I'm pretty, every time I go on it, I'm convinced I'm going to fall off and die every time. And I have this, and I have this dread, and then I have this moment of kind of serene tranquility of, oh, well, if I'm going to go, at least I'm going to enjoy the view. And then I don't die because it's a goddamn roller coaster and it's been engineered to not kill me. which really is what, you know, I'm not saying that horror is the same way, because I think horror is designed to give you this big, you know, this creeping, good horror, I feel, does this kind of creeps in, and to the point where you don't realize it's kind of festering and growing in you, and then bleh, you know.
One that, wonders I'm not, why people seek out this sort of experience. I mean, I generally don't watch horror movies that are just pure horror movies, because I find them unpleasant. I mean, they're I don't mind violent elements. I mean, excitement is entertaining, and occasionally, you know, things being scary is entertaining. But things being, you know, grotesque and unsettling and unpleasant, and why do people seek that out? Why is that a positive thing?
Well, it's a part of human history. I mean, like, think of in Roman times, watching the gladiator fights and people being fed to lions and that sort of thing. There's kind of a thrill to watching something that you're not supposed to, and I think that gets to this idea of the uncanny, in that we crave the uncanny. We want to see things that shouldn't exist, but then exist because it gets us to question things.
Like, who the hell came up with this?
Well, I mean, like, action movies can sometimes get gory, and depending on, I don't know, some people just like gore, I guess, for its own sake. I can either be attracted by gore if I think it's, you know, appropriate. If it was a really person that I really didn't like and wanted to see him die horribly, I can kind of enjoy that in a kind of twisted sort of way. But to see, like, innocent victims ripped limb from them, I really don't want to see that.
Right.
I think I may be not part of the majority in that sense.
Well, there's, you know, within horror itself, there seems to be a lot of divisions lately. Like, you have, you know, gore, and then you have horror. And gore being stuff like Saw, or we could probably put slasher films in with that. And that definitely has its appeal. But you'll notice that, like, these days, we seem to be more, at least in America, it seems to be more about the gore and less about the horror, which I would attribute to, like, ghost stories and that sort of thing. So I'm curious about that trend.
Right, so
yeah, we went through sorry, Tom, no, Tom, go ahead.
I was going to say, it's like, you know, did something supernatural do it, or did a chainsaw do it? You know,
Supernatural chainsaw.
There we go.
There we go.
Ghost lumberjack.
Yeah.
Also, gore is easy, but true. But actually, scaring someone, you know, with like a ghost story—that's that actually takes skill.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, I mean, you remember there was a period of about like 10, 15 years ago where Western cinema, which is a very, very polite way to describe the Hollywood industry, the filmmaking industry in Hollywood, went through a period of remaking all of these Japanese horror movies, like The Grudge and The Ring and the Ringtone. I don't know what that one was actually called, with the phone that rang. You know? That's a real one, though. I don't know what the actual name of it was, but that was... One Missed Call. One Missed Call was what it was called. But yeah, we went through a period of those kind of almost psychological, you know, that kind of horror... was very very in vogue here in the Western world for quite a while, and we then went back to kind of the torture porn of things like Saw and Hostel and the Hostel Saw and the Saw Hostel and I Saw Hostel.
Well, you also have to draw a distinction between what people want and what the industry makes. The industry could make all those Japanese horror movies because they had Japanese horror movies to copy from. So once they ran out, they went back to doing what they know, which is more torture porn.
I'm going to disagree with that just a little bit, and this time it's actually because I've been listening. they stopped making. I mean, the Japanese love horror, and they have a wealth of mythology and concepts to pull from. But the an imagery as well, some fantastically terrifying imagery. But the one of the reasons why Hollywood stopped remaking Japanese horror movies is twofold. Number one, they had a couple of films in a run there that didn't do very well, like One Missed Call, the one I was just making fun of, did horribly in the US. It was terrible. It did really, really poorly. But the other thing is, it's also become cheaper to make found footage style movies like Paranormal Activity. Right. And was it always watching a Marble Hornets story, which is interesting because that's actually based on a web series, the web series Marble Hornets, which at its best was absolutely terrifying, and that was kind of a slow burn, like that you'd have episodes sometimes, you know, 5 or 6 episodes in a row where there wasn't really anything scary happening, but it was just kind of stacking
just the
information.
Mood.
Yeah, setting the mood and kind of giving you more information as the characters were kind of investigating what was happening, and then something big would happen.
The other thing about Marble Hornets was also the fact that it wasn't in a continuous order, that they would kind of, like, show the repercussions of something happening, and you wouldn't quite know what's going on, and then they would go back later and, like, I found another tape that shows the lead-up to the event that happens, and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Full disclosure, by the way, I do know some of the guys who made Marble Hornets, so I feel like journalistic integrity, even though I'm not a journalist, I do have to kind of bring that up, but
it doesn't stop the check from coming.
It doesn't. If you haven't already, buy Marble Hornets seasons 1-3 on Blu-ray, available now at marblehornetsstore.com. I don't know if that's the actual website address.
Well, you were mentioning, we were talking about those Japanese the remakes, and I haven't seen a ton of Japanese horror, but from what I've gathered, a lot of it's based around ghosts, right?
There's a lot of it, and there's that recurring image in a lot of Japanese horror of the, you know, the girl in the white with the long white robe and the black long messy hair.
Well, and I'm wondering if maybe that's why ghost stories aren't so popular here in the U.S. because Japan has a rich history of that sort of thing, whereas in the U.S. we do not necessarily have that. Now they're all hunting the ghosts. Thing. Now it's a bunch of guys hunting ghosts in an asylum and trying to catch them. Yeah, I watch all those shitty ghost shows. It's an addiction of mine. I feel terrible about it, but I love ghost adventures. I also like Paranormal Activity, so feel free to hate on me a little bit.
Oh, no, I mean...
Like, they're not good movies. They're not good movies, but I enjoy the crap out of them.
Paranormal Activity, what it does in an acceptable manner. It's not terrible. I mean, I think for the money they have and for the story they're trying to tell. Like, I found the first Paranormal Activity movie to be a deeply, deeply boring movie. Like, I sat down and I watched it and I was bored. And so I started to kind of MST3K it a little bit. And I'll watch it again because that's how I watched that movie. I felt the same way about the Blair Witch Project. I actually kind of feel like the found footage genre doesn't really work. And I think there's a very good reason why, hey, I'm British, guess what I'm going to do? I'm going to bring up Doctor Who. There was a found footage episode of Doctor Who in last year's season that is almost universally considered to be the only bad episode that came out last year.
Mm. Yeah, I remember that episode and I wasn't too impressed with it.
Yeah, I think it played with the format in an interesting way. I think there's some stuff that the writer Mark Gatiss chose to do that I think was interesting, you know, especially with the kind of perspective shift between the characters and the fact that they actually weren't wearing helmet cams and that, like, some of that stuff I thought was interesting, but I don't think the found footage format works if you're trying to tell a scary story. If you're trying to tell any story, I don't think it works. I think the closest thing we've ever had to found footage that works is Peep Show, which is a British comedy, and it's not technically found footage, it's just that we see everything from the perspective of the characters in the show. And that works, and it's funny, but I don't find found footage to be inherently scary. Actually, I guess Marble Hornets technically counts, and that did have some very, very scary moments throughout.
So you just blew away your argument just now.
I did blow away my argument. Once again, I sit upon my throne of deceit, and I lie, and I lie, and I lie.
Well, I guess what we should probably do is maybe transition into some of our ideas of how we can do effective horror comics. So I actually have some tweets that we received, and then maybe we can kind of use those as launching off points for our thoughts on this. How do you guys feel about that?
Let's give that a go.
All right.
Okay. So a large portion of horror comes from making the mundane unsettling. So, at Def Beck on Twitter asks, how do you make the mundane unsettling?
I'm not sure I agree with the premise of the question, because a lot of horror is not based about making the mundane unsettling. It's about introducing supernatural elements. However, with that in mind, it's because the traditional ways to be really violent, and I think that's has diminishing returns. And I think as horror movies and as they become more and more violent, I think that's harder and harder to do correctly. So,
well, I'm going to go ahead and disagree with you on the idea of mundane not being unsettling, because one of my favorite horror movies that came out recently was The Witch, and that was all about like playing up on this psychology, and this is like a mundane story about people who are banished from their community and trying to survive, and just all the extremes of personality start kind of increasing.
But I mean, even in cases where there's not an explicitly supernatural element, there's a very unusual situation. So when you say mundane, you know, if there's like, I mean, you can have like a sort of a post-apocalyptic or you know, plague situation where society is collapsing and some really horrific things are happening. That's not exactly mundane. It's a pretty extreme situation.
So maybe it's not the mundane exactly, but like surreality. Just the idea of the surreal, and like, how do you introduce that? Maybe.
I don't know. I mean, there are ways of taking. I mean, because think about it. Before Stephen Moffat became showrunner of Doctor Who, of course, I'm going to mention Doctor Who.
Every time he mentions Doctor Who, take a shot.
Oh, that was a thing for a long time. For a very long time. But yeah, you know, Stephen Moffat's thing was taking something very simple and making it scary. Like in a lot of instances, it was about taking something very very integral to childhood and making it scary. That's something that Moffat did very well. Blink is basically, you know, it's the game Freeze that kids play on playgrounds, and The Empty Child is. I don't know, Tag? I don't know. But I mean, there's stuff in Silence in the Library and Forest of the Dead, particularly, you know, the fear of the dark is pretty basic. But even in the second part of that story, when Donna is trapped in that kind of simulated computer world, the fear of losing your children, that your children would just vanish, the way that is set up and that fear is kind of stacked and elevated, and then you get the payoff... is just expertly done. Like that's a story that has scares in it for kids and for adults.
Right.
I promise the next thing I say won't be about Doctor Who.
Well, it depends on what gets said next, because it can always start you off on a Doctor Who tangent.
Well, Doctor Who known for its grotesque horror elements. He said sarcastically.
I actually can't rebut that, but I also promise the next thing I said would not be about Doctor Who, so I have to keep my mouth shut.
Okay, so maybe we weren't able to answer that question so much, but we do have another one that...
Well, I think it's amazing, before we move on,
well, science fiction writers...
Oh, could right, fair enough.
Before we move on, you can take something, like, just to be unsettling, like, you take something perfectly normal, like, say, like, the radiator in the corner of my room.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I, you know, it goes dark and then lights come back on and now the radiator's in the other corner, I'd be pretty unsettled. I mean, radiator's pretty mundane. It moving from one corner to the other is not, but...
You
know. Yeah. Right, so it's the act of surprise then, I guess?
Or just like, yeah, something's a little off. Or in that case,
right.
It'd be very off, but... That would be a surprise.
Yeah, no, I'm thinking about that now, and I'm thinking, oh god, what if I wake up one night and my TV is, like, right next to me instead of in front of me?
Yeah.
So I'll have nightmares about that. Thank you, Tom.
No problem.
I used to genuinely have nightmares about my computer turning itself on when I was a kid, I would have nightmares about my computer turning itself on and going Skynet. to the point where, I'm not kidding, like, I was, even up to the point where I was like 10, 11 years old, I would unplug my computer from the outlet before I went to bed so that it didn't, because I had nightmares about it. I had nightmares that my computer was, I'd be playing a game and then the screen would go black and then this red countdown would appear on the screen and I instinctively knew this means something's happening.
Judgment
and
day.
I would turn to call for my parents, like, something's wrong, and the door to the office would slam shut on its own. Like, you laugh, but when you're a kid, that's terrifying. So,
terrifying.
And that's the computer that I would, you know, I'd play, you know, Super Frog and Worms and Thundercats on when I was a kid, you know. I turned that into
a short film.
I had to unplug it before I went to bed. I had to do it. I couldn't sleep knowing it was plugged in.
So one night you're going to wake up and your computer's going to turn on by itself and you're just going to lose your shit.
Well, that's no! The thing. I leave my computer on sleep mode these days when I go to bed, and I have cats, so they will occasionally jump up and
turn
the keyboard and wake up the computer. So I'll wake up and the room will be illuminated with, you know, my screen and my light-up keyboard, and I'll go, oh, yes, it was on sleep mode, the cats, probably. Oh, well, silly me, good night. And then it will happen again 27 minutes later.
Right. But going along with that, though, I mean, where you unplugged the computer every night, if you, you know, woke up and it's plugged back in now, again, pretty mundane, but pretty unsettling if you're pretty sure you unplugged it.
I mean, it wouldn't have, as a kid, that probably wouldn't have caused me any consternation, because we only had the one computer. It was a family computer. It was an Amiga 1200. So if it had been plugged back in, that means my dad was probably using it. Although saying that, he did once...
Wait a minute. The computer wasn't even in your room?
It was a household computer. Yeah, it was
in the computer. Get up and walk to your bedroom?
I was terrified that something would happen and the world would end because I hadn't unplugged the computer at night.
I was with you up to that point, but
the computer grew legs.
I mean, I say that if it got plugged back in, that's fine, because, you know, my dad probably would have done it, but he was yelling at me once because he thought I'd burnt out the power supply somehow. Computer's not working. What did you do, Ben? You must have done something. And I was really upset because I thought, oh no, what have I done? And then I realized, wait, no, I just didn't plug. I haven't plugged it in yet. So I told him, no, I unplugged it. I just haven't. It just needs to be plugged back in. So I plugged it in, and he never said, I'm sorry. He was just, wow, I'm remembering this for the first time. And I
had a real breakthrough today, Ben.
Yeah. Wait a minute, he never apologized. That son of a bitch.
And you know what? He's never going to. He wouldn't anyway, but because he's no longer among the living, it's not something that he's capable of doing. I brought that down, didn't I?
Yeah. But if he did, that would be scary.
I have a story that kind of relates to this. It actually happened to me. It's one of those things, whenever I think of something that scares me, it's one of those things that I always think about. Okay, in the U.S., when I was a kid, there was this toy robot called 2XL. I don't know if you guys maybe have any memory of this toy robot. It was like a tape deck. And then you would, like, press the button, and it would forward the tape just a little bit. And, like, he would ask you a question, and you pressed a button, and then you would answer the questions that way.
Yeah, there were a couple that had, like, 8-track tapes, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, my parents had bought one for me at a yard sale. And I tell you, I love that thing. I played with it, like, every day. But I was always very conscious, number one, to turn it off at night, because batteries were expensive. And then, number two, to always put it on my top shelf in my bedroom, because my brother would always try to get to it and play with it. So, this was, like, a nightly thing for me, you know what I mean? So... one night, I was out in the living room playing video games, and it was like 2 in the morning because it was summer vacation. I didn't have anything else to do. And I swear to God, I heard that robot laugh from my bedroom.
Oh, no.
And I swear to God, and that totally happened. It freaked me out, and no one had gone in there and touched the robot or anything like that. You know, and I had checked, and it was on the shelf, and it was off and everything like that. Needless to say, I slept out in the living room. But, you know, a year ago, I was recalling, because I was talking with some coworkers about ghost stories, and I mentioned that, and they were all freaked out by that, and I thought that was cool, so I decided to talk to my mom about that situation, and she drops this bombshell on me. That toy was picked up at a yard sale that was being sold by the parents of a child who had died of cancer, and it was his favorite toy.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so that's one of those things, when I think of horror, I'm just like, that. I always think of that, because it's one of those things where it's just like that whole idea of the mundane, this toy robot I would play with every day, but one night it just plays by itself or something like that.
That so, is slightly terrifying.
It is horrifying, isn't it?
Just a bit. Okay, so I'm looking up online, by the way. There were two versions of the 2XL.
Right, I had the 90s one.
Yeah, there was the one that looked kind of like Rob the Robot. That was from the 90s. It uses cassettes. And then there was one from the 70s that was made by the Mego Corporation that looked more like if R2-D2 and a Dalek had had a baby.
Right. Yeah. Well, and actually, the other day I pulled up a YouTube video of the laugh of the robot, and it was just so distinct, and it sent shivers down my spine, because you can't mistake that noise for anything else. You know, here I am playing Nintendo, you'd think, like, an electronic noise, okay, maybe I got confused, but no, this is definitely the laugh.
So, were you just off, or did you actually take the batteries out?
I turned it off, and I took the batteries out.
Okay. Because if you just turned it off, it could have been a short or something, but if the batteries were actually out, then that's a little bit harder to explain.
Yeah, I recall, you know, and this was when I was a kid, so maybe I didn't take the batteries out, but from what I remember, I think I took the batteries out. So.
So did you eventually get used to it and sleep in your room, or did you move it out?
Oh, it was just that one night that it freaked me out, and then eventually I sold it because I needed money, but it was just one of those things where it's like, to have that situation, and then like years later find out that it used to belong to a kid who died. It kind of gave the story a little more oomph to me for some reason.
So did you warn the people that you were selling it to that it was demonically possessed?
I did not, because I didn't know what to think. I was just freaked out at the time, and I'm just like, I tried to rationalize it, and like, oh, it was just something goofy going on, but maybe.
Well, you know they're dead now.
Yeah, I probably killed a family.
Did you sell it to him? Sell it to him real cheap? I'll give you a good deal. In fact, I'll pay you to take it away.
Just make sure you don't put any batteries in it.
Well, gotta move these haunted toys somehow.
And you don't, you know, and don't get it wet, and don't feed it after midnight. Oh, never mind.
That's right. Yeah.
There is legitimately an entire like cottage industry on eBay of people selling quote unquote haunted dolls.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Yeah, that was just recent, wasn't it?
It all happened very recently, and also continues to happen in an ongoing fashion from the beginning of time.
The media blitz over it.
The media is kind of crazy. I know that the guys at my brother and me used to do a regular like haunted doll watch.
That would be interesting to do.
Speaking of mundane things that creep people out, dolls.
Oh yeah.
Case in point.
Do you ever watch that show Ghost Adventures at all? Oh, any of you? They had an episode on a location called Doll Island, where it is literally just this little island in the middle of a river, and it is just filled with dolls, like all sorts of old toy dolls, and the most horrific thing.
Anymore. That's terrifying.
Oh wait, are you afraid of dolls?
No, I'm afraid of the people who set that up.
Okay, this is a legitimate fear that I have. I'm scared of mannequins and dolls. Like, not when I say mannequins, I mean ventriloquist dummies, and also actual, like, store window mannequins.
Oh, God. And autons.
That's actually a fairly common fear.
I had to kind of get over it a little bit, because I spent, between August and February, I slept in a room with a ventriloquist dummy and didn't want to say anything to my friends whose house I was staying at, because I didn't want to be that guy. Like, could you please move your terrifying hell beast? I didn't want to do that.
So did you ever have an experience where you went to bed and it, like, was in one position and then you wake up and it's in another position?
No, it had never done that, thankfully. And I think the more I acclimatized to this ventriloquist dummy, and I think I'm okay with that one, but I'm thinking of ventriloquist dummies as a concept, and I'm getting a little anxious.
Oh, God.
Is there any... Okay, would there be any interest in a half-baked haunted doll watch? Because I have actually brought up an eBay listing for a haunted doll. If you guys want to hear this.
Okay.
Okay, all right. With my apologies to the McElroys for stealing their bit. The entry is Spirit of Tiffany, haunted 3-foot doll, antique doll, authentic paranormal vessel. Here is the body of the text. I found Tiffany on a local Facebook auction page. The poster was desperate to get rid of her, saying that if she didn't sell, she was going in the trash. I won her, and the woman was so eager to get rid of her, she came to my house and left Tiffany on my doorstep. It was 2 hours earlier than the time we agreed upon, and I was asleep, so I didn't hear her try to message me or hear the doorbell. She just left her on my doorstep and didn't care that I didn't give her any money. I even offered to pay, and she wouldn't come back.
So why didn't she just leave it on a neighbor's doorstep or something at some other time?
Because it's not real.
There's probably more to this story. I shall continue.
That's why my major is going to be bad for me, because I'll keep thinking of stuff like that when people tell me stories.
So I even offered to pay and she wouldn't come back. I soon found out why. This 3-foot-tall doll is an active vessel for Tiffany's spirit, something that many people unfamiliar with the paranormal have difficulty handling. She has a pull string in her back, and I'm going to include a video of her distorted voice box saying, quote, "I'm trapped."
So, what's the difference between an active paranormal vessel and a passive paranormal vessel?
If I had to guess, I would say a passive vessel is a vessel that has contained something or has the potential to contain a spirit of some sort, but present does not. It's like an empty hotel room.
Got
like
it. Thanks there is for clearing
the potential.
That up.
Yeah, there's the potential for someone to be there, and there may be some, ectoplasmic residue on the sheets that needs to be washed out, but absolutely will not.
Anyone who buys a passive vessel is getting ripped off then. Because if I want to get haunted, I'm going to buy something that's going to actively haunt my ass.
Here's the interesting thing. I'm going to skip ahead a little bit on this entry, because for some reason, this woman has the entire history of the doll, despite the fact that the woman ran away without the money and never came back.
Yeah.
So the entry says, Tiffany passed away when she was only 5 years old. It was the 1960s. She couldn't tell me the exact year. It was in Texas. Tiffany was playing outside with her cousins when their ball ended up in the street. She ran to retrieve it and was struck by a speeding car and dragged.
Well, I mean, she gives you that she wouldn't tell me. Obviously, the doll's talking to her. That's where she got the information.
I guess the doll is relaying information, like maybe like sending text messages at 3 a.m.
It's writing on the wall in crayon.
Actually, you're right. There is the part of the part that I skipped over says, Tiffany really does not enjoy being contained in her vessel, and she needs someone to either keep her comfortable as possible or help her depart more completely. I have been keeping Tiffany comfortable, offering her friendship and understanding, listening to her and talking to her gently, but I have not been able to help her completely free her spirit to the other side.
Which is why I'm putting her up on eBay.
Yeah, of course. Unfortunately, Tiffany did not pass away immediately. She suffered and passed right as the ambulance arrived. Wow, this is pretty fucking melodramatic. Tiffany has not only described this dream to me via spirit board, I guess that's how the communication is happening, she has shown me in a dream. It was a horrific scene, and it breaks my heart that she went through such suffering.
Oh, that's amazing. I'm going to need a link to that stuff later.
Please consider adopting Tiffany and being her new keeper and possibly the one that frees her after all these years. That is a heavy... You're asking a lot of me.
Yeah, wow. Seller.
This doll is $140.
Oh, is that the buy it now link for it? $140?
That is the buy it now, or you can make
it. Has
offer.
A buy it now?
Has a buy it now.
I gotta get haunted right now.
No returns.
There's more than one.
I am required... as per eBay's policy on the paranormal, to indicate that eBay forbids the sale of intangible items, and this listing is for a doll only, with no promise of spirit attached. eBay requires me to say, for entertainment purposes only.
Oh, can we just do this every episode?
I would absolutely do this. I would do this all the time.
So good.
So if the spirit's damaged in shipping, you know, sorry.
She'll end up being pissed when she gets to your house.
I love this. There's a closing paragraph that is, I would like to address the single negative feedback I received from a very rude buyer. If you look at the feedback this person has left for others, they actually told someone, quote, "You suck," and that's why they bought from them was just a doll. How incredibly juvenile is... And that what they bought from them was just a doll. How incredibly juvenile is that? Anyone that is familiar with spirited vessels knows that it takes time, sometimes a long time, to see any paranormal activity. It
Again,
varies.
There's clearly more than one. Someone's watching her before.
You could buy a whole doll.
How many freaking haunted dolls does this girl have? How many haunted dolls were left anonymously by someone she didn't know? on her doorstep. I mean,
I want to look at this person. I want to see how many haunted dolls she is presently trying to move.
I mean, is there like a rash of illegal haunted doll leaving?
Oh my god, this is fantastic. Here? Okay, so she's selling three items. She is selling the Spirit of Tiffany, which I've already shown you. She is selling the Spirit of Emma Lynn, Haunted Porcelain Doll, Active Authentic Paranormal Vessel, and my personal favorite item, the Morpheus Drop Tune Polyphonic Pitch Drop Guitar Pedal with Power Supply.
For entertaining the dolls.
I wonder if this is haunted. Is this haunted?
It was just in her garage.
It isn't haunted, but it does state no returns, so maybe.
But then it comes back.
Like she sold this polyphonic pitch drop 18 times, and every time she mails it out, it comes back.
Yep, there's a horror story for you.
Yeah, that's insane, right?
Do we have time for a couple more reader questions?
Yeah, let's
sure.
I think we can.
Okay. All right, that was fun. Okay, so this is from at Socks and Ladders. What are the very worst horror tropes that just don't work but get used all the time anyway?
Jump scares
can work, but they're overused.
They can, but they're overused particularly by they're incredibly cheap. They're overused by Western cinema. They're overused by horror video games, or quote unquote horror video games, like the later Dead Space games. Doom 3 is a good example of a game that makes excessive use of jump scares. Jump scares, as I stated earlier, have diminishing returns. Like, there's a reason why there are so few jump scares in a game like, for example, the original Silent Hill. It has them, but it doesn't have many, and they are spaced so far apart and between so much other genuinely scary shit. Like, I hate jump scares, not because they're scary. Jump scares can be scary, as you guys have said, but they're just overused. They're kind of passé.
Well, a jump scare has to be earned. It has to ratchet up the your tension level has to be ratcheted up so high anyway, and then the jump scare is supposed to serve as the release for that.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, with a lot of cinema these days, it's just the idea of, you know, the woman closes the bathroom mirror and then, or closes the cabinet above the sink, and then in the mirror there's someone behind her. It's just a cheap device.
Well, that's like the worst horror trope ever.
Right,
the mirror behind the bad thing in the mirror behind the person. The other one is walking backwards into something.
Yeah,
I'm really scared, but I'm gonna walk backwards and not look where I'm going.
The trope of the final girl, that might be another one. You know, at the end of the horror movie, there's a final girl.
Oh yeah, I feel like Cabin in the Woods kind of lampshaded that pretty wonderfully.
I love Cabin in the Woods so much.
It's such a great film.
Very much so. Yeah, Cabin in the Woods is great. If you're a horror fan and you just want to, like really see people who understand how horror works and just, like, shoot the shit out of it, Cabin in the Woods is great.
Cabin in the Woods is phenomenal. It's one of my all-time favorite things. Okay, just a sidebar, I am going to put something in the Skype chat, which we can describe for our listeners if you want. It's an image. I'm giving you fair warning. It is pretty scary. It scared the Wiggins out of me when I saw it. And I can't... it's a deeply unsettling image from Disney on Ice, for the listener. It is an image from Disney on Ice of two of their skaters dressed as, I'm guessing, Marlin and Dory from the hit Pixar movie Finding Nemo. But it is such an unsettling image... I find myself unable, perhaps maybe psychologically unwilling, to describe the true extent of the terror within this image.
It's pretty good body horror.
Now, are those women? Because the eyes look...
So,
this could be.
I'm more concerned about the distended mouth stomachs.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
That's pretty horrifying.
But since the... Since the listeners have no idea what we're talking about, maybe we should move on.
we could always put in the show notes.
We could describe it in great detail.
Yeah, or we could move on.
Okay, so I think that's all the questions we had about horror, but we do have a more general webcomic question. So this is from at Coda Otan, who does the comic The Errant Apprentice, which is fantastic. I'm a big fan. He has the question, how should I go about getting more readers? You know, if you have any advice, smiley face. So I figured to show how friendly he is by showing the smiley face. So.
Nice.
The, there's no trick to getting more readers. Make a good comic and build it and they will come.
Right. Well, but then also there are ways to kind of get a jump start and to get people to look at your stuff. Like one way that I've found is through doing fan art.
Right.
Of other people's works. It just like putting yourself out there, like on social media and that sort of thing.
Yeah, be present on the Tumblrs, be present on the Twitters and the Facebooks, and the Pinterest, is that a one? Snapchat?
Pinterest, not super, from my experience, Pinterest hasn't been like super useful. MySpace? Instagram, though, on the other hand.
Instagram is a good one. Bebo, yeah. Habbo Hotel is great. I'm pretty fond of Face Party. I think Face Party is pretty rad.
Facial party, what?
Different thing entirely. I'm a member of FetLife as well. FetLife is a great social
media.
Okay, Cupid.
Adult friend finder.
Soulgeek.com is good. we're laughing, but that's a genuine geek website.
Yes.
A geek data website, which I work for.
Jack.
The other side of that coin, though, is if you're spending too much time doing that, it's taking away from putting quality into your actual work, which is, of course, the actual bread and butter.
Oh yeah, you can't do too much of. You've got to balance it. You know, you've got to.
Yeah.
The more streamlined your process is, the better. So, like for example, doing like. Whenever I want to promote Cosmic Dash stuff coming out, I actually have like a promo image template, and then I slide a panel onto it, and then use that for a post.
Yeah, something like that. But there's an old Steve Martin joke that he's written a book on how to be a millionaire, and step one is to get $1 million, and I feel that comic readership is pretty much the same thing. You know, how to get 1 million readers? Well, first thing, get 1 million people to read your comic.
Yeah.
Then of course, the issue is keeping, the readers and, getting that ball rolling.
Well, I guess what we can probably do then is like, okay, we know that part of the deal is making a good comic and creating stuff that people are going to want to read, but beyond that, what are some things that a person can do to kind of get their work out there and noticed by people?
The three things are be good, be consistent, and be interesting. Like, I know, not everyone who's going to be producing, good, interesting work on a consistent basis is going to get 1 million readers overnight, but that's going to happen. It might take some time. You also like advertise, like use resources like Project Wonderful to advertise on. But you can spend $1 million a week advertising, but if you're not doing something that people are interested in, that people want to read and want to read more of, you're not going to accumulate readers. I know that's a really simple thing to do, but make sure you're making something that people give a shit about.
Right. Yes. I think being involved in social media and getting yourself out there is valuable. Advertising, unless you're willing to spend a lot of money, is really not that useful.
And another thing is to know your demographic. If you have a comic about a specific subject, go after people who are interested in that subject.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a very good point. I would also suggest networking with other artists who do work that's similar to your own or who do projects that are similar to your own, because then, like, for example, let's take Quark Comics, that we all kind of do these science fiction projects and we kind of network with each other. So that's another way to kind of get people to put eyes on your work.
Well, that's by being active on social media, I don't just mean tweeting everything you do, because if no one's following you, no one's going to hear it. I mean being active on social media and interacting with other people. And other content creators would be the people to interact with.
Right. And that can be through simply just like letting them know what you think of their work, or like doing a doodle of one of their characters, that sort of stuff. That's stuff that I do, and it's worked out for me so far. Mm-hmm. So,
hey guys, you want to hear something genuinely scary?
No. Yes.
Sure.
Billy Corgan has gone full, like, Billy Corgan of the Smashing Pumpkins now looks like and is basically an old white man, and hates social justice and hates the idea of equality, and that's fear right there.
I'm sorry, hating social justice. Okay, let's not even go there.
Not on this podcast. Wrong show.
Okay,
that'll be for a spinoff podcast. Fear the Billy Corgan.
So it is nice to know, Ben, that you're surfing the web instead of paying attention to the podcast.
it just came up on Twitter while we were talking. Like,
is it just the shit on Ben episode? Is that what this one is?
I'm not gonna lie.
Shit on Ben episode.
In fairness, between my call, like randomly dropping like midway through the episode several points, I have basically been phoning it in. So.
Oh, we can tell.
Yeah.
Technically, we're all phoning
it. Yeah, technically. Yeah.
Why are we never in the same room?
I'm sorry.
One of these days, I'm gonna actually be on my phone. I'll be like, I couldn't get to a microphone. I couldn't get to an actual microphone. Or
you're running
internet.
Back to your house with your phone. I'm trying to get there, guys. We'll do it here.
Do it live.
All right. So that I guess that's it with the reader questions. Now, Mark, did you have something that you wanted to bring up, or do we want to save that for another episode?
Do we want to save that for next time?
Yeah, I would say. Yeah. I think that's a pretty robust subject. Let's save it for next week.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So then, does anyone have any final thoughts on the writing of horror or anything else?
Boo! I need pizza.
I guess we should probably close it up. Does anyone want to handle that, or should I?
Go ahead.
Okay. All right. So this has been Podwarp 1999. We've had Jim, Tom, Mark, Ben, and then me, David. And we thank you for listening.
Good night.
Ciao.
Boo.
Leave it in.
Thanks, guys.
Well, I'm sorry I know nothing about horror.
Oh, no.
Yeah, we know that you just checked it. You logged off and just came back.
I laughed at some jokes that, you know.
But, you did about as well as Ben did.
Yeah.
The intro and outro music is Earth's Assault on the Central AI by Tetix from the album Technology Crisis. A link to Tetix's website is available on the Podwarp 1999 website.